Put on the head. Chaos and disorder are unpredictable and unavoidable as well in most cases, even for the best risk analysts and decision makers. Nassim Nicholas Taleb, the best-selling author of The Black Swan, lays out how we can protect ourselves from adverse events and even gain from them in his latest book, Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain from Disorder. It's published by Random House. It's interesting that it's called Random House. And I'm very pleased to welcome Nassim Nicholas Taleb, the Distinguished Professor of Risk Engineering at NYU's Polytechnic Institute, to our show today. Hello.
Great. Thank you very much for inviting me again. I mean, usually people don't invite me to come back to this, but people forget. I'm kidding. Thanks a lot. I'm on.
Well, let's get back to The Black Swan.
Yes.
When you wrote it in 2007, you introduced the concept of black swans. Can you explain what they are?
Yeah, what happened is that they are events of very low probability. You don't know. You can't predict them because they're very low probability, very hard to predict. But when they happen, they have a massive impact. And I call them high-impact, low-probability events. It so happened that there's some domain, some area, say history, economic life, business life, cultural life, that are entirely dominated by black swans, where the regular is cumulatively inconsequential in the long run. Okay, like, for example, you take the entire stock market, you have 100-some-thousand companies have started, the capitalization, half the capitalization comes from a couple of hundred companies out of the entire market, for example. Same in book sales. You have a million writers, or people call themselves writers. A small number of writers control half the profits of that industry.
Well, some are predictable bestsellers, but others are surprise bestsellers.
After the fact. So before the fact, okay, these events, these black swans, are unpredictable. After the fact, it's called retrospectively, they're very predictable. And then we always find explanations. And because we're very good at explaining things, you know, we, the human race, are a little ahead of ourselves intellectually. So we're very good at explaining things. So we think, have this illusion of being able to predict the next black swan.
Did you invent this theory?
Well, I mean, there was a Roman poet who used the expression, a good spouse is as rare as a black swan, okay? He didn't say, he used the word rare, so they had to be, have been spotted, but exist, but nearly impossible to find.
Now, you worked as a mathematical trader for 20 years, and the timing of the black swan felt prescient because you published that book right before the 2008 financial crisis. You say we never see black swans coming, but did you see the financial crash coming?
It was so. What happened is that my idea of the black swan, and this will ease us into the idea, the topic of the new book. The idea of the black swan was misinterpreted. I was not inviting people to predict black swans. I was telling them they're unpredictable. I was telling them to be robust to them, to try to avoid getting in trouble, because we can identify domains in which that can be negatively affected by black swans.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up with this detection method, okay, that was not published in the black swan, but here, how to figure out if a system is fragile. And the financial system was very fragile. So I said, there's things I can't predict. But one thing I'm going to tell you is that if a bridge is very fragile, it eventually is going to collapse.
Well, you wrote in the Wall Street Journal last week that some made the mistake of thinking that you hope to see us develop better methods for predicting black swans. What were you hoping for?
No, but when I wrote The Black Swan, I wanted to alert people that there are some risks we don't understand and try to avoid them or have a huge buffer against them. They didn't get it, and I, of course, said the financial system is very fragile, okay, and if it collapses, it wouldn't be a black swan. But we're getting close to Thanksgiving, and the central anecdote of the book is the story of the turkey. And there's a principle that a black swan for the turkey is not a black swan for the butcher. Mm-hmm. So in the book, a turkey is fed every day for 1,000 days by a butcher, and every day confirms to the turkey's science research department that the butcher loves turkeys with increased statistical confidence. Until the day, like exactly today, the eve of Thanksgiving, it's never a good idea to be a turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the turkey will have a surprise. So I tell people, it's a surprise for the turkey. Is it a surprise for the butcher? No. So my entire idea of the black swan was not to be a turkey.
Mm-hmm.
You see? You find the turkeys, you know the turkeys eventually are going to blow up. So this is how I left the black swan. I left the idea, but the book was published about a year and a half before the crisis. And it was very frustrating because people wouldn't get my message. So I added a section to the book during the crisis. You're not understanding that the idea is about robustness. Be robust, it's not to be a turkey. But it was still not satisfactory. And here I'm continuing the story with a concept that's a little more advanced and harder to grasp by academics, but very easy to grasp by cab drivers.
You're calling it Incerto.
The overall piece is called Incerto, the overall series. Fooled by Randomness was my first volume, and I think the first interview ever I had was in this studio 10 years ago. Then The Black Swan, and this is, to me, is a solution. The first two books identified a problem. This one is just recipes, how to deal with opacity, uncertainty, lack of knowledge. So this book starts with the following principle, that if you don't know what's going on, okay, you don't rely on predictive methods. Don't fool yourself by inventing theories saying you can predict, just get out of trouble. And this is something that's part of, you know, the way the Romans used to think. The other thing is that, hey, you know what? There are a lot of things that benefit from disorder.
So figure out how to take advantage of it.
Figure out how to take advantage of it, all right? Why not be the butcher? Why do you have to be the turkey, you see?
My guest is Nassim Nicholas Taleb. His latest book, Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain from Disorder. It is published by Random House. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So the concept is being the opposite of fragile?
Okay, so when you ask people, what's the opposite of fragile? And I tried in every single language for years, they would answer robust, solid, adaptable, resilient. That's not it. If I have a package, and the package is fragile, I'm sending China to my cousin in Siberia, Western Siberia, I'm sending him a package, and it's going to, you know, it's fragile. You say handle with care in Russian, English, and whatever local language, in Kazakhstan language, all right? You send the package. Now, the opposite of that, cannot be a package on which you'd write nothing. You see, the opposite of that would be a package on which you'd write, please mishandle. This is anti-fragile. Something solid, you write nothing on it. You don't write solid, I don't care. So the opposite of fragile is effectively something that gains from harm. And the Greeks understood it. They had and identified three categories of fragilities with the Greek. The first one is Damocles. You're sitting down, you know, if something happens, you're waiting, nothing good can happen to you. You have a Damocles, there's a sword hanging over the head of a king at a banquet, and it is, as the expression has developed since, hanging by thread. Then you have Phoenix. Phoenix is like the robust, the resilient, the solid. You shoot it, it comes back the way it was. You cannot harm it, you don't help it. Hydra, on the other hand, Hydra wants you to harm it, because if you cut one head to grow back, and you have to identify what in life has these Hydra-like properties. So many, once you open up. Then I made a big discovery, really, what was behind this book, because I have discussed these things in The Black Swan, in my earlier writings, and even in my doctoral thesis years ago. But I read a major book by a person called David Deutscher. In it, he explained that we could be colorblind culturally, but not colorblind biologically. A lot of people can see the difference between blue and other colors, but may not have a name for blue.
Mm-hmm.
And effectively, the ancient Greeks did not have a name for blue. In Homer, there's no word for blue. The wine, dark sea. Okay, and even in ancient Hebrew, there's no word for blue. It came later.
The word orange only comes along when we get the fruit from Spain.
Exactly. I mean, the word orange is actually...
Naranja.
Yeah, but the orange comes doesn't have a Greek name. So portocalli, because the Portuguese brought it from Goa. It's artificial as well. But so the word blue, there was no word for blue. And I realized that by naming something, then you can develop a policy-making approach based on naming something. So I realized I had to use find a name. Well, the opposite of fragile is visibly anti-fragile, but that was not an elegant name. So I spent 2 or 3 years fighting with people, looking for a name, and finally it's the least elegant possible name you can have for a concept, but that's what we have.
Now, you in the book, you define fragile as what wants to be left alone in peace and predictability.
Exactly. So what... part of my research is, I mean, I spent all my life doing something called volatility trading and working on mathematical models on how things react to volatility.
And you were supposed to be predicting what was...
No, I was not. No, I was just, instead of predicting, I was measuring how things react to volatility. Mm-hmm. And in finance, there are things that react to volatility and they have a very specific property. Like options have some specific what I call disliking of volatility properties. So I realized looking at a coffee cup on my desk. Actually, there's a coffee cup on your desk. We're not going to try the experiment. That this coffee cup has nothing to gain from disorder. So it is effectively phobic to volatility. So fragility is what does not like volatility. Once I have that definition, I can write it down mathematically, and we can find the opposite is what likes volatility.
And you say anti-fragile is similar to long gamma. What does that mean?
That's a word we use in derivatives. That's the only word that was that the color blue. In other words, the color blue for option traders. Yeah. When I was an option trader, we had something called long gamma, likes volatility. All right, and I tried to apply it to life, and it's a very simple definition. If you'd rather have variability in things rather than having them fixed, then you are anti-fragile and you need volatility. You need these stressors. So now once I came up with this word, anti-fragile, start seeing it everywhere. And my first application was what I call the difference between the cat and the washing machine. You see, a washing machine is fragile. There's absolutely nothing you could, on its own, it's not going to repair itself, so it needs constant monitoring. But you and I need some stressors. Otherwise, we'd lose in bone density. This is why people go to the gym and then overpay in New York City. They overcharge you for the gym to go exercise your anti-fragile. You need some disorder. You need some shock. The anti-fragile is what likes disorders, variability, volatility, all stressors, these kind of things. So I realized that not only we don't have a name for anti-fragile, but we're harming so many things by depriving them of variability. In the medical field, for example, they discover heuristically, but they really weren't aware of it, that sometimes instead of giving a dose of medication, two doses of equal doses, all right, on two successive days, you give a very little one day and a lot the second day. So you have variability. The variability is effectively the spice of life, what makes life good.
Although, aren't we told that economic stability is the best? You have been talking about how the Greeks and Romans thought about these things, but in the in this post-Enlightenment age, don't we like to think of the world as functioning in an almost Newtonian way as a,
machine? That's the biggest.
And we do not want any disruption.
That's the problem. The problem is that trying to iron out the business cycle is what Greenspan did. Trying to kill every volatility in economic life has fragilized the system. Just like if I put a kid in a sterilized room for 12 and a half years, and he's going to be fine, no germs, and then you invite him to take a ride in New York subway, how many seconds is it going to last? Right? Okay,
yes.
So you see how many, he's going to,
We need to develop our...
We need some
resistance to
everything. We need variability in so many realms of life. People can understand it, but not translate into economic life. That if you had no variability, no stressors, zero in economic life, would be like these forests. And they eliminate every systematically, every small fire, and the big fire is always worse.
Is that what led us to thinking that real estate prices would always go up and that the stock market would continually rise, the Dow Jones would continually rise?
Asset bubbles, what happened is that Greenspan, by eliminating the business cycle, created a new class of people who had never lost money. So they thought they were invincible and could take a lot of risks. So he had a lot of risks hiding under the surface, just like in a forest that hadn't had a fire in a long time. The first fire, you know, will be horrendous because all this material, you know, very flammable, hiding. So the system doesn't clean itself up. Just like our body, you know, when you have hunger once in a while, you have your system cleans itself up, so mechanism of autophagy. So they didn't understand it, and they wanted to remove everything. So the aim of an economy should not be stability, but anti-fragility.
My guest is Nassim Nicholas Taleb, who is the Distinguished Professor of Risk Engineering at New York University's Polytechnic Institute and also the author of a number of books. The one we are discussing is called Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain from Disorder. It's published by Random House. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Nassim Nicholas Taleb, his book, Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain from Disorder. It's published by Random House. For a second, I got lost there. You write about the fragilists. Who are they?
Fragilistas. It's like a barista at Starbucks. You have the fragilista. The fragilista is a person who wants to install order from the top. Okay, and I call it, you'll get the idea once I give you the synonym, the Soviet Harvard type of person, and there's something I call the Soviet Harvard illusion.
You mean the people who come up with 5-year plans in the case
everything,
of
everything, 5-year everything. They want to monitor. They think they understand the world. What happens is that, anti-fragility, of course, when I say something is anti-fragile, in other words, you gain from disorder. You also gain from the unexpected, because the unexpected, you don't have to worry about black swan, hits you overall positively. They want to eliminate everything from every variation in life, the fragilista. So there's an economic fragilista wants to eliminate the seasons in economic life, right? Policy-making fragilistas wants to have absolutely, everything planned top-down, you see. So what happened is that these people cause fragilities in the long run, like as Greenspan blew us up by micromanaging us.
And if you are a Chinese or a Soviet planner who believed in a 3- or 5-year plan, you weren't throwing in a drought. You weren't throwing in all these.
You're preventing the national. America. I came to America, and I think like a lot of people came to America who were not born here, who chose to be here because you can. It's a place where you can have aggressive risk taking, and of course it is benefits from disorder. Not a place where you go study at a university and then you follow a civil servant plan with meetings at 9:15 every Wednesday in a boardroom. That's not what it's all about. So economic life grows bottom up. And I tried to map this with the concept of likes volatility and the effect of volatility by finding metrics to express that. And what is fragile? Okay, what is anti-fragile in economic life? And what systems gain from it? So, for example, a top-down centralized system tends to be vulnerable to large mistakes. Just like an elephant breaks a leg much more easily than a rat. Actually, a rat, which I don't know if you want to experiment. If you have a rat, you can throw it out the window and maybe unharmed. An elephant breaks a leg immediately, all right, at the smallest shock. So they tend to have things that are large, big, over-planned, eliminating all sorts of randomness. And they have this illusion that technology comes from science. They have this belief in academic culture. I looked at the data. I spent 5 years looking at the data, and it's exact opposite. Growth, technology, all these come from tinkerers, people playing, trial and error, okay, in a disorderly way. And then when something is discovered later on, some scientists will write a book on it, all right, and they will have academic papers, and people forget that didn't come from academia.
But are you saying we should have an unregulated situation? Because so many of the problems that we have faced have been the result of a pulling back of any kind of government intervention in the market economy.
No, no. The way I mapped it, because in a way, regulation fragilized. Some regulations fragilize, some don't. Okay, what do we have to regulate and not regulate? We want small is beautiful, okay? And I explained why small is beautiful to start with projects, okay? Why the top-down doesn't work. A project of $100 million has a lot more percentage overruns than a project of $5 million. So that's the first thing. It's much more stable to distribute the decision-making across municipalities and cities, okay, than have a central planner in Brussels or in Washington. Okay, and look at Switzerland, a very successful country, entirely bottom-up, much safer. To continue with what needs to be regulated, not regulated, there are things, if you regulate a system, you don't have, sometimes you favor a certain class of people. And at the end of my book, I start talking about ethics, and I have something that's called skin in the game, not skin in the game. I'd rather have apply the Hammurabi rule than the regulation. And let me explain to you what
it is.
You
mean an eye for an eye?
And let me tell you the situation. There's a class of people who are anti-fragile. They benefit from the disorder. They're not harmed by it. Okay.
They're too big to fail.
Someone who has a corporate executive, a bureaucrat, they're not responsible for the decision. They have the upside. You are anti-fragile if you have more upside than downside. And you are fragile if you have more downside than upside in any situation. And there's a class of people who have the upside, no downside. Okay, the banker, they earn bonus. That's not capitalism. Capitalism is about having both upside and downside. So what happened is that at no time in history have we had a class of people who transfer the fragility to others. And the beginning, the first, you know, the code of Hammurabi, 3,750 years ago, that's the beginning of civilization, the rules probably preceded, but the first rule was as follows. If an architect builds a house and the house collapses and kills the owner, the architect, engineer, that is, shall be put to death. Now, I'm not advocating eliminating the engineers and architects from the population, but the idea is a deterrent, because you know you are responsible for the harm you may cause to others. And think about it, no regulator will ever know more about the foundations and what material you have in the foundation than the engineer who put it there. So that skin in the game was generalized. And the eye for eye also comes from it's the same root of things that provides a symmetry. In other words, you don't have the upside without downside. And this we lost. Look at this crisis. A bureaucrat doesn't have that. Now, in a small environment like Switzerland, or a person has feel shame. If you overspend the money of the municipality, you see people at church on Sunday, you feel shame. But if you're a bureaucrat in Washington, it's a number.
But Switzerland is a smaller country. Switzerland doesn't have an automobile industry. You're suggesting
not,
we don't have a bailout.
No, no,
in effect,
I am not.
Aren't you?
I am saying that ahead of time. First of all, you should bail out individuals, not companies.
So what would have happened with Detroit? We would have.
Of course, what I'm saying is not. Of course, when you have a problem and you have you're at the brink, we should have a situation ahead of time that sort of protects us from bailouts. And one of the rules I have is as follows: a company that we'd have to bail out, if one day that company fails, is de facto, okay, their employees are de facto civil servants. So they can't pay themselves, like Detroit or the bankers, hundreds of millions of dollars of bonuses, billions, okay? And then later on, the taxpayer have to bail them out, and they keep the upside, not downside. So the idea of bailout can be prevented ahead of time by systems of clawback, by systems that prevent this asymmetry. You see, by having some kind of Hammurabi rule there, is that if your company is bailed out and you're the chairman, your past bonuses and past performance, from past performance, have to be revert to the taxpayer. There's something I call here the Bob Rubin problem, Robert Rubin, former Secretary of State. He was at Citibank for a dozen years.
Not Secretary of State. He was
Secretary of Treasury before. He was at Citibank later on. So you see that they gave $120 million in bonuses. Citibank was bailed out. You and I are retrospectively, we're New York, we're U.S. taxpayers, we're retrospectively paying for it. So this is one of the rules at the end to stabilize the system. It's not stabilization ad hoc by policies here and there. And definitely the regulator regulation is important, but not it's not a panacea.
Uncertainty and disorder may not be as bad as they seem. In fact, they can be beneficial for us. That's the topic of Nassim Nicholas Taleb's latest book called Antifragile, Things That Gain from Disorder. In it, you have created a character named Fat Tony. Who's
yes.
he?
Fat Tony.
He winds up getting into a debate with Socrates.
Exactly. So Fat Tony, it wasn't a black swan. Okay, and Fat Tony versus Dr. John. Fat Tony was a skeptic. Dr. John went by the textbook. So Fat Tony is from Brooklyn, and he is street smart. And a lot of people suggested that now I'd imitate his accent, but I think I'm incapable of it, right? So he's one of the characters of the book.
Well, I'm from Brooklyn. You want me to do it?
Okay. So he's, as his name indicates, all right, did very well, detecting fragility in others. He smells fragility. So that's one of his that's how he entered the book. And towards the middle of the book, all right, Fat Tony has to debate Socrates, and it's sort of reviving the old debate started by Nietzsche. Nietzsche figured out what problem we have in society. He went after Socrates because for Nietzsche, you have two kind of approaches. You have the Apollonian and the Dionysian. The Apollonian is using brain and balance and harmony. And the Dionysian is that dark force that you release when you get drunk or when you have an Dionysian after Bacchus, Dionysos, Bacchus, the god of wine. So you have these two tensions in the individual. And for him, what happened is by the time of Socrates, we killed this opaque. You see, we killed this disorder, okay? So everything we shifted to order, all right? That was Nietzsche.
He thought it was a big mistake.
A big mistake to have this imbalance between, you know, we need order and we need disorder, right? And my book is not about entirely disorder. Is where is it that we need order and how to have a balance of disorder in the system? So Fat Tony debates Socrates because Socrates was harassing people about doing things without understanding why they do them. And the point is that there are a lot of things you and I do that we don't understand. That we have inherited, either it's biological or we have inherited from practices from generations, all right? And these things are robust without intellectualizing them. They're very robust. And what the unintelligible is not necessarily unintelligent. And that was what Fat Tony was fighting Socrates for. Mm-hmm. And Socrates, and of course, Fat Tony won the debate, but again, the game was rigged in favor of Fat Tony.
Well, of course, when you're writing it, you can always beat Socrates or Plato.
It's very easy to beat the argument once you've had Nietzsche, because Nietzsche really won the debate, but people don't know it yet. And I was vindicating Nietzsche through Fat Tony, the street smart from Brooklyn.
So let's get down to basics. How can we become anti-fragile?
Well, I mean, I have rules for whatever I can come up with. I mean, my claim to fame isn't so much having big theories, but having simple measurements for fragility, right? By avoiding some fragilities. Debt fragilizes. So debt fragilizes, but of course, sometimes you need it, right? But you have to. It shouldn't be a good thing. The second thing is size. Size is good if you're building. You want an airline company, Boeing. Size is okay, all right. But there are businesses that hit their size limit very early. So plus they can hijack us with a too big to fail. You see?
But you say that compare businesses benefiting from their mistakes with evolution in the natural world. So are you saying that businesses that make mistakes are doing well?
No, the businesses that make small mistakes. Remember, the central thing, I always remind the reader every chapter and a quarter, right?
That so when Apple fragile, comes up with a lousy map, that actually is a good thing because they'll then correct it.
No. So their business is type one is small mistakes. Mistakes have small costs, all right? But they do well if they're hit with a random event, the error is small and the gains are large. So that's anti-fragility. Is mm-hmm. errors, I mean, costs are small and gains are large. And fragility is the reverse. Now, some businesses thrive on mistakes and gain from it. And these are benign businesses, like the airline industry, not financially, but the safety-wise. Every crash we've had has helped reduce the probability of the next one. So for every crash makes your next, transportation safer. Okay. Same with trains. Same with the restaurant business. Every bankruptcy of a restaurant improves what food you're going to get on a table for your whatever.
On the other hand, as somebody who used to work in the market, that you don't invest in the airlines.
No.
Not because it crashes, but because of other factors.
No, they are. But I'm talking about from a safety standpoint. Okay, not from from the financial standpoint. I'm limiting the fragility to the physical one. But
time is also fragile here. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. But Nassim Taleb will be giving a reading, speaking, and signing books next Tuesday at 7 o'clock at the Union Square Barnes and Noble store. Then next Wednesday at 7 o'clock, he'll be doing the same at the Powerhouse Arena at 37 Main Street in Brooklyn. Check our show page for more details. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for inviting me.